Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 119. It's Monday, June 21st. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, I wanted to start up with a follow-up and do more on the FDA's huge mistake in approving a new Alzheimer's drug with very sketchy efficacy data. So let's start with, from a story from Medical Express, three FDA advisors quit over agency approval of Aduhelm. Three members of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration Advisory Committee have resigned after the agency approved a new drug for Alzheimer's disease despite a lack of strong proof that it provides any benefits to patients. Aduhelm, a monthly infusion priced at $56,000 per year, is the first treatment for Alzheimer's disease approved by the FDA in 18 years, and its approval was pushed by patient advocacy groups because there are only five other treatments available, the New York Times reported. However, none of the 11 members of the FDA advisory committee that reviewed the new treatment considered the drug ready for approval. 10 voted against approval, and one was uncertain. The FDA is not required to follow its advisory committee's recommendations. The committee said there was no conclusive evidence that Aduhelm could slow mental decline in people in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease and noted that it could cause potentially serious side effects of brain swelling and brain bleeding. Dr. Joel Perlmutter, a neurologist at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, was the first to resign from the advisory committee after the FDA approved Aduhelm. Approval of a drug that is not effective has serious potential to impair future research into new treatments that may be effective, he said. In addition, the implementation of Aduhelm therapy will potentially cost billions of dollars, and these dollars may be better spent in either developing better evidence for this drug or other therapeutic interventions. For months, several experts, including some involved in the drug's clinical trials, have said the available evidence about Aduhelm raises significant doubts about its effectiveness. They also suggested that even if it achieves the claimed benefit of slowing the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease by about 4 months over 18 months, that might be barely noticed by patients and would not outweigh the risk for brain side effects. Okay, and next up from the Washington Post, furor rages over FDA approval of controversial Alzheimer's drug. Much of the debate centers on the FDA's surprise decision to approve a broad label for the treatment, which theoretically means any of the more than 6 million people with Alzheimer's could receive it. As a practical matter, doctors and insurers will be left to decide whether to restrict the drug to the population actually studied in the clinical trials, people with mild cognitive impairment and early dementia, both caused by Alzheimer's. That's a job many physicians and insurers are unhappy to be stuck with, saying more FDA guidance is needed. Other critics have complained about the FDA's use of, quote, accelerated approval, which relies on a, quote, surrogate endpoint that is thought likely to predict clinical benefit, but is not a measure of benefit itself. In this case, the surrogate is reduction in amyloid, a sticky compound that many scientists believe damages communication between brain cells and eventually kills them. Patrizia Cavazzoni, director of the FDA's Drug Center, noted to reporters last week that accelerated approval has led to, quote, a dramatic leap forward in the cancer space in the past 20 years, and we believe it serves as a model that we can hope can be replicated with neurodegenerative diseases. Many advocates welcome that approach, but some critics have faulted the oncology process, saying it allows costly drugs onto the market that don't necessarily prolong survival. And they say getting an ineffective drug off the market is difficult. In Congress, some Democrats are complaining about the price of the new Alzheimer's drug made by the Massachusetts-based biotech giant Biogen and threatening congressional hearings. In an interview with Representative Peter Welch, Democrat from Vermont, he called the price cruel, noting that beneficiaries in the traditional Medicare program would face cost sharing of more than $11,000 a year if they did not have supplemental insurance coverage, and Part B premiums could go up for everyone else. Another complication is that the PET scans used to detect amyloid clumps, critical to diagnosing Alzheimer's, can cost thousands of dollars and are not covered by Medicare. Nor are the multiple follow-up scans needed to check for tiny brain bleeds, sometimes caused by the drug. Because the drug is administered in doctor's offices and other outpatient settings, it will be included under Medicare Part B, which covers expensive intravenous drugs for cancer and other diseases. The Kaiser Family Foundation recently estimated that if 1 million Medicare beneficiaries receive Aduhelm, the total spent in a single year would be $57 billion. Medicare spent $37 billion on all Part B drugs in 2019. Despite the unanswered questions, doctors are scrambling to figure out how to give the drug and to whom. They say patients have been phoning, texting, and emailing constantly since the FDA approval was announced June 7th. And next up from Axios, Aduhelm will balloon America's health spending. Aduhelm, the Alzheimer's treatment controversially approved by the FDA, won't just put Medicare's budget in peril. The $56,000 per year drug could single-handedly represent 1 percentage point of all healthcare spending by next year, according to an analysis from Alterum. Why it matters. Americans already pay more for healthcare than any other country. But since Aduhelm is not close to being a cure, and not even proven to halt the progression of Alzheimer's, the resultant growth in spending will therefore be sustained for the foreseeable future. By the numbers, Aduhelm, an IV medication administered in hospitals and infusion centers, will raise spending on all prescription drugs by 8% in the next few years, Alterum forecasts. Flashback. Drug spending shot up by 12% in 2014 after Gilead's pricey hepatitis C pills, Sovaldi and Harvoni, hit the market. But sales of hepatitis C medicines have declined since. Most people are cured after one round of treatment. That wouldn't be the case with Aduhelm. Worth noting, the analysis doesn't factor in additional spending on PET scans, MRAs, facility fees, and other procedures and tests associated with administering Aduhelm. And lastly, from Mad in America, FDA approves failed Alzheimer's drug. Members of the panel also wrote an article in JAMA detailing how the drug failed and how the FDA collaborated with Biogen's reanalysis of the data, which they wrote, quote, potentially compromised the FDA's objectivity. Following the drug's approval, three members of the FDA's advisory committee resigned. Aaron Kesselheim, who had served on the committee since 2015, wrote that the approval of the drug was probably the worst drug approval decision in recent U.S. history. Additionally, the FDA has lowered its thresholds by abandoning the scientific process. In order to be valid, evidence must come from clinical trials that predict an outcome and set pre-specified targets. It's the scientific equivalent of shooting arrows at the bullseye. The real test of ability comes in painting the bullseye before, not after, the arrows land. While there's nothing wrong with the post-hoc analysis conducted by Biogen, it's a necessary step in finding patterns for further investigation. It cannot prove causation and does not provide scientific evidence for efficacy. While it's possible that this drug has cognitive benefits, the data as they exist are clearly insufficient to support a claim of efficacy. Even overlooking the distortions introduced by the premature termination of the trials and the findings of one positive and one negative result, the finding of one positive and one negative result is a statement of inconclusiveness. While the conditions of approval stipulate that further evidence must be collected in post-market trials, the collection of this data often proves problematic. According to the FDA, the trial must be carried out with, quote, due diligence, leaving much ambiguity in how quickly they have to be conducted. Exondys 51, a drug approved for muscular dystrophy in 2016, still hasn't completed its post-market trials. As with Aduhelm, the FDA's advisory panel voted, though much more narrowly, against the drug. The panel's decision was overruled by Janet Woodcock, who now serves as acting commissioner of the FDA. A company like Biogen has, at best, only a chance of confirming the efficacy of what they're already selling. If results aren't favorable, they stand to lose a major source of revenue. Meanwhile, it can be difficult to enroll individuals for the post-market trial, given that they stand the chance of receiving a placebo instead of a drug that's already on the market. With a wholesale price of $56,000 per year, Biogen may have a strong incentive to delay as long as possible. Here, too, the drug has been criticized by experts. According to the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, Aduhelm would be cost-effective if priced from $2,500 to $8,300, which could lead many private and public insurers unwilling to cover the drug. Others have asked what a reasonable price would be for a drug that actually shows a significant impact on Alzheimer's if Aduhelm is already priced so high. Ultimately, the FDA's decision on Aduhelm will have far-reaching impacts on future research. As another member of the advisory panel said, "If we approve something where the data is not strong, we have the risk of delaying good treatment and effective treatment for more than a couple years." Moreover, with their disinterest in acquiring basic evidence for the drug, their controversial use of the accelerated approval pathway, and their overruling of a nearly unanimous advisory board vote against the drug, the FDA sets a precedent that could facilitate the approval of more ineffective and harmful drugs in the future. Yikes. I must admit, I am pretty baffled about how this ever made it through the approval process. I suspect that this might actually be some of the dark side of patient advocacy. When people are desperate for a treatment, they'll take anything, even if it isn't really proven to work, in the desperate hope for something that may work. And while many people may be sympathetic to that view, in public health, we really have to look, as in other areas of life, for what's called the opportunity cost. Say that this costs $80,000 a year, and that might have to be administered for many years. One of the questions we could ask is, if we were going to spend $80,000 a year on somebody with dementia, are there other forms of assistance that actually might produce more benefit in the lives of people with dementia? Then, of course, broadening it further, you could say, are there other health or public health interventions that might be way more cost-effective and more effective in bringing about health amongst people and the population? So I think it's interesting, if you look at really the bottom line is, if this works with the mild results that they had in the one trial that worked, and of course the other one didn't show effectiveness, they were saying that if it works, a reasonable cost-effective price would be somewhere between $2,500 a year and $8,300 a year. So we're not even in that ballpark, in the big if it even works. Okay, well, let's move to some COVID-19 news, and I promise you it'll be the least COVID-19 news I've done in over a year. This from The Guardian. Delta variant COVID symptoms include headaches, sore throat, and runny nose. Headaches, a sore throat, and runny nose are the most common symptoms associated with the UK's most widely established COVID variant, researchers have said. The data collected as part of the app-based Zoe COVID symptom study suggests that the Delta variant first detected in India feels like a bad cold, according to Tim Spector, a professor of genetic epidemiology at King's College London, who is leading the work. COVID is acting differently now. It presents more like a bad cold, he said. People might think that they just got some sort of seasonal cold and they still go out to parties. We think this is fueling a lot of the problem. So what's really important to realize is that since the start of May, we've been looking at the top symptoms in all the app users, and they're not the same as they were. So the number one symptom is headache, followed by sore throat, runny nose, and fever. The classic COVID symptoms are fever, cough, and loss of smell or taste. Spector said that with Delta, a cough appears to be the fifth most common symptom, and the loss of smell doesn't even make the top 10. Data suggests that the Delta variant is at least 40% more transmissible than the Alpha variant, and appears to double the risk of hospitalization. It also renders vaccines somewhat less effective, particularly after only one dose. I think the message here is that if you're young and getting milder symptoms anyway, you might just feel like a bad cold or some funny feeling. Do stay at home and do get a test. So this is really important because as we look in the months ahead, when we finally get to cold and flu and COVID season, it's going to be much harder to differentiate COVID from cold and flu. And that may make it more difficult to actually deal with this Delta variant, which is the one that's likely to be predominant and is the most serious that we'll be dealing with likely in the fall. Okay, well, let's do the local COVID-19 update. As far as Lucas County's average daily cases, it's actually holding steady at a rate of 16, which is the same as it was last week and a little higher than it was even a couple weeks ago. So it seems that there's a little bit of a bifurcation between what's happening in Lucas County and what's happening in the state and even what's happening nationally. While it's still going down in Ohio, it looks like in Lucas County it's kind of leveled off. And actually, as a nation, it looks like the rates have leveled off. So while for a number of months there, clearly we're winning the race between vaccinations and variants, it looks like it's a little bit more even now, fortunately at a much lower level. But the rate of 68 in Lucas County is still higher than the rate of 50 or less that Ohio was originally looking at for getting rid of COVID mitigation efforts. And we're still higher than that in Ohio, although Ohio is still continuing to drop and is now at a rate of 36. So Lucas County is almost twice as high as the Ohio rate. But another good news, the positivity rates is declining and still continues to decline rather precipitously in both Lucas County and Ohio. So that's good news. We're still getting cases in nursing homes. We had 6 active cases over the last week, but that's only 1 resident and 5 staff. And we're still trying to get down to that lowest level. We had 5 one week and 4 several months ago, but we've been at 6 and 9 and 6 the last several weeks. So hopefully we can set a new record on that soon. Well, new hospitalizations also have leveled off in Lucas County while they are declining again in Ohio. Deaths nationally have continued to decline rather steadily and we're under an average of 300 a day. Now, of course, 300 a day would still be over 100,000 a year, which would be like the most wicked flu season ever, but it is moving in the right direction. Okay, as far as vaccinations, of those who in the U.S. who've received at least one dose, it's 53.3% in the U.S., although over the last 2 weeks, there's been less than a 1% increase week over week. So it is slowing, and it's slowed even faster in Ohio and Lucas County, both of which only upped their vaccination rates by about 0.5% of the population over the last week. So there seems to be a growing disparity between the U.S. and Ohio and a growing disparity between Ohio and Lucas County. You are listening to Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Okay, well, let's do a couple short vaccination-related stories. This from Medical Express, and I hadn't heard of this one before, how important this was. Half of unvaccinated adults have needle phobia. If you're among the 25% of Americans averse to needles, you're probably not surprised by the COVID-19 immunization stall. Even for those who want immunity, bribery with beer or lottery tickets may not be enough to override anxiety made worse by pervasive images of needles in the media. Needle fear has increased dramatically since a landmark 1995 study by J.G. Hamilton reported that 10% of adults and 25% of children feared needles. In that paper, adult patients who remembered when their fear began described a stressful needle experience around age 5. The childhood experiences of the patients usually related to an unexpected illness. At the time the Hamilton participants were in preschool, vaccines were scheduled only until age 2. For most people born after 1980, however, boosters injections given between ages 4 and 6 became a routine part of the vaccine experience. The timing of boosters maximizes and prolongs immunity, but unfortunately falls within the age window when phobias are formed. A 2012 Canadian study of over 1,000 children found that 63% of those born in 2000 or later now fear needles. In a 2017 study, my colleagues and I confirmed this increase in prevalence. Half of preschoolers who got all of their boosters on one day, often 4 or 5 injections at once, were still severely afraid of needles as preteens. Unsurprisingly, needle fear affects how willing teens and adults are to get vaccinated. A 2016 study found needle fear to be the most common reason teens didn't get their second HPV vaccine. Healthcare workers are no exception. A 2018 study found that 27% of hospital employees dodge flu vaccines due to needle fears. And most recently, an April 2021 national survey of 600 not yet COVID-19 vaccinated U.S. adults found that 52% reported moderate to severe needle fear. Okay, this is a much longer article and it goes into potential solutions for adults. And I would just advise that if you're interested in that story, like all the other stories I report on, you can go read them online at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Okay, well, in a little more optimistic vaccination news, there's an interesting story about some research out of the UK from Medical Express. 52% of those who, quote, definitely wouldn't get vaccinated have gotten their jabs. Half, or 52% of those who said they would definitely not get a COVID-19 vaccine when asked back in November-December 2020, have now done so, indicating that many people's hesitancy has disappeared since the UK's vaccine rollout began, according to a new study. Among people who said they were not very or not likely at all to accept a vaccine when asked last year, an even greater share, 84%, have since been vaccinated. Woohoo! Good news. So the good news with the immunizations and the vaccines is that once you get fully vaccinated, it kind of takes you off the playing field and you should be safe and it should help the community overall. So you don't have to do it once, or in the case of the two-dose ones, you have to get two doses to get fully vaccinated. So just do it. Okay, well, since we're talking about vaccinations and COVID, most people are aware that there's an awful lot of conspiracy theories going around. And I want to take this moment to debut my new parody PSA, the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy. I've avoided in my coverage to spend a lot of time trying to debunk myths and conspiracy theories. So this is my take on conspiracy theories. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, the last COVID-19 story I want to cover is actually a little bit of a better news. This from Medical Express. Study links COVID-19 public health efforts to dramatic drop in COPD hospitalizations. Researchers at the University of Maryland School of Medicine analyzed data at their 13-hospital University of Maryland medical system and found public health measures designed to reduce the spread of the COVID-19 virus may have fostered a substantial side effect. Hospital admissions for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, were reduced by 53%, according to a new study published in the American Journal of Medicine. This is likely due to a drop in circulating seasonal respiratory viruses such as influenza. Hospitalizations for COPD, a group of lung diseases that make it hard to breathe and get worse over time, are commonly driven by flare-ups, where symptoms are triggered by such factors as tobacco smoke, air pollution, and respiratory infections. Seasonal respiratory viruses, including those that cause the common cold or influenza, trigger nearly half of those flare-ups. In the wake of the marked drop in COPD admissions during the pandemic, the researchers theorize that COVID-19 behavior changes, a mix of stay-at-home orders, social distancing, masking mandates, and strict limitations on large gatherings, not only protected against COVID-19, but they may have also reduced exposure to other respiratory infections. Conversely, they worry that the return to normal behavior may lead to more COPD flare-ups. Our study shows there's a silver lining to the behavior changes beyond protecting against COVID-19, said senior author Robert Reed, professor of medicine and pulmonologist at the University of Maryland Medical Center. If we completely eliminate mass and distancing during cold and flu season, we'll allow all these viruses to have been effectively suppressed to come raging back. There could be a lot of illness. As more and more people are vaccinated against COVID-19 and many of the public health measures of the past year are relaxed, the researchers warn that a full return to normal may again expose COPD patients to the familiar seasonal triggers. Our study did not assess which public health components work to tame seasonal respiratory viruses, but a simple thing like wearing a mask while riding on public transit or working from home when you're sick with a cold could go a long way to reduce virus exposure, said Dr. Reed. This is a compelling study that raises some important public health questions about protecting our most vulnerable patient populations after we are finished with the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, it's an interesting story, partly because it shows the interface of a chronic disease with an acute infectious disease. And if nearly half of the chronic disease of COPD is driving hospitals by, you know, colds and flus and COVID and that type of thing, then we need to deal with infectious disease to deal with long-term chronic diseases as well. And I'll take this time to make a note on the impact of COVID-19 versus other causes of death. I speak occasionally about a measure called years of potential life loss, which is basically looking at the years based on a life expectancy at any given age that somebody has when they die of something. And you count up those years, and it tells you about basically how much years of life you're preventing. And they just came out with data for 2020, and based on that, COVID-19 fell in between heart disease and cancer. So the notion that COVID-19 is something that only kills off old people, it's certainly not any more true than our leading causes of heart disease and cancer. So when someone dies of heart disease, it takes about 13.4 years of potential life off their life. For COVID-19, it's a little higher than that, 14.3 years of potential life lost. Cancer is even higher at 17 years of potential life lost. So those are the main killers that we've seen as ongoing with heart disease and cancer, and most recently with COVID-19. But as another way of comparison, if you look at unintentional injuries, which would be like motor vehicle crashes, unintentional firearm deaths, that type of thing, that actually results in 31.3 years of potential life lost per death. So obviously things that people call, quote, accidents, we don't use the term accidents in public health because we believe that there's a reason for everything and a cause for everything and that it can be addressed. So we call them unintentional injuries. But unintentional injuries result for pretty much twice the amount of the life lost per death than your other chronic diseases. There, that's your public health lesson for today, along with the rest of the show. And speaking of chronic diseases, here's this next story from Medical Express. U.S. appears to lose ground in controlling high blood pressure. After years of improvement, high blood pressure control in the U.S. dropped, regardless of age, race, or ethnicity, according to new research. They discovered the rate of control, getting blood pressure down to a specified number, has fallen by 7.5%. That's a very strong decline, said the study's lead author, Dr. Brent Egan. We lost about 10 years of progress in 4 years. Expecting to find disparities in the fall of blood pressure control by age, race, or ethnicity, the researchers found none. We were surprised by how broad-based the decline in blood pressure control was, said Egan, the vice president for cardiovascular health at the American Medical Association. But control rates weren't all that fell. Awareness of having high blood pressure slipped by 3.4%, and being treated for it dropped by 4.6%. Among those being treated, 6% fewer had the condition under control. The study also found an increase in people being prescribed just one medicine, despite a rise in obesity and diabetes, two conditions that require more intensive drug therapy for hypertension control, according to the study. If healthcare professionals are reluctant to prescribe multiple medications, and if patients are hesitant to take them, one potential answer is a combination where you have two or three blood pressure meds in a single pill. Falling rates of awareness, treatment, and treatment effectiveness occurred even though people had the same access to healthcare, the findings showed. That suggests a worsening in the quality of care for diagnosing and managing high blood pressure, which could be a result of primary care doctors being overwhelmed by patients who have multiple chronic conditions such as diabetes and obesity. It's extremely difficult to manage all these conditions in a 15-minute visit, he said. We need new approaches. We need lean, efficient improvement programs, more self-monitoring, and better public health campaigns to engage patients and get them to understand their hypertension. Dr. Gbanga Ogedegbe, who was not involved in the research, called it an important study that shows there's still many questions to be answered about high blood pressure control. In particular, he said there's a need for more research about the role obesity plays in hypertension control, especially among black people in the U.S., because American Heart Association statistics show that more than half have high blood pressure. Given the role of obesity as a major risk factor for uncontrolled hypertension, we have to focus our efforts on how to do a better job with it, said Ogedegbe, professor of population health at NYU Langone Health in New York City. He stressed the importance of addressing the upstream factors that contribute to the rise of obesity in communities of color, such as the need for more parks and better access to areas that allow people to be physically active. If we know lifestyle behaviors are important, he said, then what are we doing to encourage healthy behaviors like exercise? And of course, I would add diet, salt intake, that type of thing, definitely important. Okay, and what could be seen as a sad day in women's equality? This from Medical Express. Women now drink as much as men. For nearly a century, women have been closing the gender gap in alcohol consumption, binge drinking, and alcohol use disorder. What was previously a 3-to-1 ratio for risking drinking habits in men versus women is closer to 1-to-1 globally, a 2016 analysis of several studies suggested. And the latest U.S. data from 2019 shows that women in their teens and early 20s reported drinking and getting drunk at higher rates than their male peers, in some cases for the first time since researchers began measuring such behavior. This trend parallels the rise in mental health concerns among young women, and researchers worry the long-term effects of the COVID-19 pandemic could amplify both patterns. It's not only that we're seeing women drinking more, but that they're really being affected by this physically and mental health-wise, said Dawn Sugarman, a research psychologist at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts who has studied addiction in women. Research shows women suffer health consequences of alcohol, liver disease, heart disease, and cancer more quickly than men and even at lower levels of consumption. Perhaps most concerning is that the rising gender equality in alcohol use doesn't extend to the recognition or treatment of alcohol disorders, Sugarman said. So even as some women drink more, they're often less likely to get the help they need. Research suggests that people who drink to cope, as opposed to drinking for pleasure, have a higher risk of developing alcohol use disorder. And while every individual's reasons for drinking are different, studies have found women are more likely to drink to cope than men. Women are statistically more likely to experience childhood abuse or sexual assault than men. In recent years, studies have found rates of depression, anxiety, eating disorders, and suicide are climbing among teenage and young adult women. That could be driving their alcohol use. And the layers of stress, isolation, and trauma from COVID-19 could make things worse. One study that looked at alcohol's effect on college students early in the pandemic found increased alcohol use among those who reported higher levels of stress and anxiety. And several studies found women were more likely to report rises in drinking during the pandemic, especially if they experienced increased stress. For us to address issues with alcohol, we also need to address these pervasive issues with mental health. They are all related. What's more, despite alcohol's temporary calming properties, it actually increases anxiety, and studies show it causes brain damage and may lead to depression more quickly in women than in men. Until the 1990s, most research on alcohol focused on men. Now, as women approach parity in drinking habits, scientists are uncovering more about the unequal damage alcohol causes to their bodies. Women generally have less body water, which dissolves alcohol, than men of the same weight. That means the same number of drinks leads to higher concentrations of alcohol in the blood, and their body tissues are exposed to more alcohol per drink. The result? From less years of alcohol use, women are getting sicker faster. They're at greater risk for hangovers, blackouts, liver disease, alcohol-induced cardiovascular diseases, and certain cancers. One study found alcohol-related visits to the emergency room from 2006 to 2014 increased 70% for women compared to 58% for men. Another paper reported that the rate of alcohol-related cirrhosis rose 50% for women versus 30% for men from 2009 to 2015. And I would note that those are both big increases for both men and women. They're just somewhat faster for women. This is just another reminder that in the U.S., one of the stickiest problems that we have in public health regarding quality of life and just longevity are these diseases of despair. And alcohol use disorder and abuse falls into that category. And now for something completely different from Science Daily. New research finds 1 million early deaths in 2017 attributable to fossil fuel combustion. An interdisciplinary group of researchers from across the globe has comprehensively examined the sources and health effects of air pollution, not just on a global scale, but also individually for more than 200 countries. They found that worldwide, more than 1 million deaths were attributable to burning of fossil fuels in 2017. More than half of those deaths were attributable to coal. Pollution is at once a global crisis and a devastatingly personal problem. It was analyzed by satellites, but PM2.5, the teeny particles that can infiltrate a person's lungs, can also sicken a person who cooks dinner nightly on a cook stove. PM2.5 is the world's leading environmental risk factor mortality. So this is a good example of how epidemiology provides perspective. People are usually concerned about a lot of things in the environment. We think about, you know, cancer and, you know, all that kind of stuff, all the different carcinogens that we may be exposed to. But actually just simple run-of-the-mill pollution is actually the single largest leading cause of death. Much like smoking, which is an individual source, although you get secondhand smoke, so it's not just individual, is the single largest preventable cause of death for individual risk factors. So environmental risk factors, it's the pollution, people. Air pollution. Okay, well, let's switch gears again and do some stories on racism in health and public health. This from Stat News. The NIH releases a plan to confront structural racism. Critics say it's not enough. Saying structural racism is a chronic problem throughout biomedical research and within their own walls, leaders of the National Institutes of Health unveiled a plan intended to eliminate a big gap in grants awarded to white and minority scientists and boost funding for research on health disparities. The agency, the largest funder of biomedical research in the United States, said it would also expand a program to recruit, mentor, and retain researchers from underrepresented racial and ethnic groups and appoint diversity and inclusion officers at each of its 27 institutes and centers. The report says NIH leaders failed to acknowledge numerous firsthand accounts of racism in the workplace, and the organization has failed to attract, retain, and promote scientists from underrepresented racial and ethnic groups. Less than 2% of NIH senior investigators are black. Published in the journal Cell, the plan acknowledges that structural racism is a problem throughout society and says biomedical science is far from free of its stain. Not only have people of color experienced health inequities for centuries, the report notes, but scientists of color have been stymied in their careers by not getting adequate funding and other support from NIH. Their plan to dismantle racism, NIH Director Francis Collins and his colleagues wrote, was just the beginning of what they recognize is a, quote, monumental task. Advocates working to address inequities in science said they were encouraged by the NIH plan, but said that it is unlikely to bring about major changes, and they called on the agency to put much more money into the initiative. There's no doubt there's a sincere desire on the part of the NIH leadership to address this question. But is this enough really to move the needle? Asked Freeman Harbowski, a black mathematician and president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. The NIH doles out more than $40 billion in research dollars each year. The agency has been sharply criticized for entrenched disparities that see black researchers funded at a rate barely half that of white researchers, 55%, a gap that has remained steady for the past decade. The new plan includes a number of programs, many already underway, to close numerous racial, ethnic, and gender gaps at the Institute. In a major focus on the significant underfunding of research on minority health and disparities, NIH leaders plan to spend $60 million on projects aimed at reducing health disparities and another $30 million to study and address the impact of structural racism and discrimination on minority health. This new funding is meant to help address the funding gap. One study suggests that topic choice, focusing on community-based research as opposed to mechanistic science, explains 20% of the racial funding disparity. Many who have been on the front lines of work to increase diversity in science say that they are happy to see NIH addressing racism, but that NIH leaders need to do far more work. This report is a solid first step, said Harbowski, whose university's Meyerhoff Scholars Program has produced the most black undergraduates in the U.S. that go on to receive doctorates in the natural sciences and engineering. In fact, viral immunologist Kismetia Corbett, who led an NIH team that conducted groundbreaking research instrumental to Moderna's coronavirus vaccine, is now at the Harvard School of Public Health, is one famous graduate. Harbowski chaired a National Academies panel investigating how to improve diversity in STEM a decade ago, when just 2.1% of people with doctoral degrees in science were black. Today, it is 2.3%. We really have not made much progress, he said. The question we have to ask our society and NIH is what will it take to change the culture? Harbowski said he believes solving long-standing problems such as unequal research funding and low number of scientists of color would require far more funding than the report had pledged. He said universities also need to work harder to increase the pool of scientists of color in a position to apply for NIH grants by supporting them from their undergraduate years through graduate school, postdoctoral positions, and their first faculty jobs. Omolola Eniola Adefeso, a black professor of chemical engineering at the University of Michigan, has been sharply critical of funding disparities at NIH. In February, she and a large group of fellow women biomedical engineers wrote an editorial called Fund Black Scientists, which cited evidence that black scientists must spend twice as much time on grants in order to be funded at the same rate as white scientists and are less likely to receive tenure in part because they don't receive as many large NIH grants, such as R01s. NIH must change course, the group wrote. Asked to review the new plan for STAT, she said she found it disappointing. There's nothing in that plan that is transformational, she said. Even though the plan pledged to stop siloing diversity issues, she said its focus on addressing funding disparities by increasing support for health equity research was itself siloing. Healthcare disparities are important, but black primary investigators are also interested in robotics, gene therapy, and CRISPR, she said. In some ways, that's pigeonholing us. That's saying you should tell a young black girl who wants to study nanotechnology to study health disparities instead. She said the NIH needed to repair the grant review process that has led to so little funding for black scientists. And if they could do that, simply fund more black scientists, regardless of what topics they study. Since there are so few black principal investigators, reaching funding parity would require a minuscule part, just 0.07% of the NIH budget, she noted. And as the NIH agreed in its plan, diverse perspectives and research teams enhance scientific productivity. But a plan to fund black investigators, she and her co-authors noted in an editorial, would likely cause a backlash from loud and privileged members of the majority. These type of uproars, they noted, are what allows racism to persist. She was frustrated the plan had not adopted more of the suggestions outlined in her group's editorial, such as prioritizing diverse research teams for funding and giving program officers the powers to reevaluate grants of black principal investigators who scored highly but just below the threshold for funding. Something she said the NIH does for research topics, it prioritizes. We gave them things we know will work because we are their reviewers and applicants, she said. She was happy to see the NIH-wide Brain Initiative, which funds neuroscience research, will for the first time use diversity of grantees as part of the grant scoring criterion. I hope that's a pilot project that has expanded to the entire NIH, she said. Bernard said the NIH was experimenting with other actions not described in the plan to close the funding gap, including increasing the diversity of grant review panels, removing names of grantees from applications, and having all reviewers undergo implicit bias training. She said she and others would be looking closely to see whether the changes have an impact on funding rates. We have a lot of work to do, she acknowledged. Manu Plott, a black professor of biomedical engineering at the George Institute of Technology, who has highlighted racism in science and academia in recent editorials and lectures, said he was excited in some ways about the plan. I love that they are doing things. I like that they're saying the word racism, he said. But Platt said he wished NIH could work faster to increase funding to black scientists to help keep them in tenured faculty positions. It's very difficult out there, he said. Funding black investigators needs to be a linchpin. Platt, who was recently asked to advise the National Institute of Biomedical Imaging and Bioengineering on diversity issues, said his experience serving on funding review panels showed him that systemic racism plays a clear role, even though race is not listed on grant applications. They look at where people trained, who they trained with, and what institution they're at. If you're at an historically black college or university or a smaller institution, you get penalized, he said. And structural racism may be playing a role in why people are not being hired at those larger institutions to begin with. It all feeds forward. The NIH could easily prioritize funding for scientists from underrepresented groups, Platt said, as it does for early career scientists to help them establish a funding track record and improve their chances of success and tenure. He said such a program would be a more direct route to increasing racial parity in funding than running programs to help improve the skills of minority scientists, such as grant writing workshops. I'd like to see more programs that don't want to fix the investigators, but want to fix the system, he said. The NIH acknowledged that its plan that the 60 programs it previously had in place to address diversity had not done enough, and that, quote, wide-scale, systematic changes that reached across the entire NIH were needed. NIH, the plan states, can no longer look the other way. Okay, well, let's expand the discussion to white supremacy in public health. This from Medical Express. Dismantling white supremacy in public health. The CDC has declared racism as a threat to public health. But when it comes to dismantling white supremacy in public health, action must be taken beyond issuing statements declaring racism a public health crisis, said Syria Lang, Associate Professor of Sociology and Health, Medicine and Society at Lehigh University. A new analysis from Lang and colleagues examines the three core functions of public health: assessment, policy development, and assurance, and the 10 recently revised essential public health services to offer strategies public health can follow to dismantle white supremacy. The article, White Supremacy and the Core Function of Public Health, by Lang and his colleagues from the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, was published in the American Journal of Public Health. The researchers found that public health has contributed to structural racism and white supremacy, mentioning that health surveillance systems do not routinely collect data on racism, schools of public health are disproportionately white, and that research led by black scholars is less likely to be funded than research led by their white counterparts. Public health research evaluates variation in the accessibility, effectiveness, and quality of health services by race, but the impact of racism and white supremacy on these outcomes are often ignored, Lang said. To combat these challenges, research suggests actions to take in response to public health's essential public health services. First, assessment. Under assessment, public health professionals are tasked with assessing and monitoring population health status, factors that influence health, and community needs and assets. Additionally, they are to investigate, diagnose, and address health problems and hazards affecting the population. The researchers suggest public health professionals consider tracking and reporting respondents' exposures to and experiences to police brutality and other indicators of structural racism and white supremacy, as well as investigate the complex mechanisms through which white supremacy shapes health outcomes. Policy development. Under policy development, tasks include communicating effectively to inform and educate people about improving health, strengthening communities and partnerships to improve health, creating and implementing policies that affect health, and utilize legal and regulatory actions designed to improve and protect health. The researchers encourage public health professionals to take action by educating public and policymakers on indicators of white supremacy and how it affects health, ensure equitable allocation of resources, and develop and enforce regulations and policies to dismantle practices that maintain structural racism and white supremacy. Assurance. Under assurance, the essential public health services include ensuring an effective system that enables equitable access to services and care, building a diverse and skilled workforce, and improving and innovating public health functions. The researchers recommend public health professionals acknowledge racist systems and advocate for anti-racist policies, set clear expectations for education on equity, focus on anti-racist methodologies, and ensure the infrastructure for teaching, research, and practice is grounded in critical race theory so that the implications of historical and contemporary manifestations of white supremacy are addressed. Public health can do better by ensuring that assessment includes data collection, monitoring, and reporting of racism pertinent to the health of black, indigenous, and people of color. Policy development must center the experiences of people most impacted by white supremacy. Assurance requires us to analyze the impact of white supremacy on training curricula, research funding and resources, racial composition of the healthcare workforce, and on health outcomes, wrote the researchers. Moving forward, Lang says public health institutions have to develop and enforce regulations and policies to dismantle practices that maintain structural racism and white supremacy. Public health cannot address racial inequities in health outcomes without addressing white supremacy in the field itself. The discipline, profession, and practice of public health and public health schools, Elaine explained. The newly revised 10 essential public health services now highlight equity, but to live up to our goal of equity, they must also tackle structural racism and its roots, white supremacy. Okay, well, a really good specific example for racism in healthcare and public health, this from The Hill. Ending sickle cell disease is a matter of racial justice. 100,000 Americans, the great majority of whom are black, have sickle cell disease, an excruciatingly painful terminal disease that on average leads to death before age 50, but for many, much younger. But my review of Symphony Health claims data revealed only 30% of these 100,000 receive any form of medical treatment despite its widespread availability. Can you imagine the outcry if only 30% of Americans with cancer receive treatment? But at least we now know clearly, understand our national deficiencies. As reported by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, for the nearly 42,000 people with sickle cell disease insured by Medicaid, only 16% of children and 10% of adults receive hydroxyurea, a daily pill that can reduce pain, prevent hospitalizations, improve function, and save lives. Even more shocking, only one-third of children received a simple annual recommended ultrasound screening to determine their risk for strokes and help prevent them from occurring. And despite the FDA approval in 2019 of two new breakthrough therapies, access to these therapies is already being thwarted by a quagmire of medical indifference, bureaucracy, and artificial barriers not supported by science. Sickle cell disease is caused by a genetic mutation in 1 out of 3 billion DNA bases, no fault of its victims. This mutation arose 7,300 years ago in a single child living in the Sahara region. One copy of this gene conferred resistance to malaria, a major killer in tropical areas, and thus the mutation flourished. Today, present in 8 to 10% of African Americans and an estimated 100 million people around the world, but when two individuals who carry a single copy of the mutation have children, on average, 1 in 4 of their children have two copies of the mutation and thus sickle cell disease. Now, because of advances in diagnostics combined with smart policies, all babies in the U.S. are now screened for sickle cell disease at birth, identified and given life-saving care by pediatric specialists. This has resulted in dramatic improvements in lifespan from the teens to mid-40s, with improvements in quality of life. However, most individuals with sickle cell disease still face overwhelming obstacles in healthcare as they become young adults and thus have their dreams of a normal life rapidly fade. Finally, in sub-Saharan Africa, where there is neither universal newborn screening nor basic sickle cell disease care, an estimated 50 to 90% of the 300,000 babies born with sickle cell disease annually will die before their fifth birthday. As such, the administration should support the newly formed Global Coalition to End Sickle Cell Disease, which Health and Human Services established in collaboration with the World Health Organization and the World Bank, by implementing inexpensive newborn screening for basic sickle cell disease. We can save the lives of an estimated 10 million children worldwide by 2050.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, the last article I'd like to cover from Science Daily is the use of PFAS in cosmetics is widespread, a new study finds. And oftentimes I run across articles where they're measuring the mere presence of toxic chemicals in different substances, whether it's food or cosmetics or whatever they might be exposed to. And this is actually not a very good way to assess risk. And it tends to be some kind of scary science because people are afraid, even if it's at present at even extremely low levels. But this study, I think, is very interesting and very scary because it's looking at higher levels of PFAS in cosmetics, and it's very common. So here we go. Use of PFAS in cosmetics widespread, new study finds. Many cosmetics sold in the United States and Canada likely contain high levels of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS, a potentially toxic class of chemicals linked to a number of serious health conditions, according to new research from the University of Notre Dame. Scientists tested more than 200 cosmetics, including concealers, foundations, eye and eyebrow products, and various lip products. According to the study, 56% of foundations and eye products, 48% of lip products, and 47% of mascaras tested were found to contain high levels of fluorine, which is an indicator of PFAS use in the product. The study was recently published in the Journal of Environmental Science and Technology Letters. These results are particularly concerning when you consider the risk of exposure to the consumer combined with the size and scale of a multi-billion-dollar industry that provides these products to millions of consumers daily. Graham Peasley, professor of physics at Notre Dame and principal investigator of the study, said, "There's the individual risk. These are products that are applied around the eyes and mouth with the potential for absorption through the skin or at the tear duct, as well as possible inhalation or ingestion. PFAS is a persistent chemical. When it gets into the bloodstream, it stays there and accumulates. There's also the additional risk of environmental contamination associated with the manufacture and disposal of these products, which could affect many more people. Previously found in non-stick cookware, treated fabrics, fast food wrappers, and most recently, the personal protective equipment used by firefighters across the country, PFAS are known as forever chemicals because the chemical compounds don't naturally degrade, which means they end up contaminating groundwater for decades after their release into the environment. Use of PFAS in foam fire suppressants has been linked to contaminated drinking water systems, prompting the Department of Defense to switch to environmentally safer alternatives, for example. Studies have linked certain PFAS to kidney cancer, testicular cancer, hypertension, thyroid disease, low birth weight, and immunotoxicity in children." Peasley and the research team tested products purchased at retail locations in the United States, as well as products purchased online in Canada. The study found high levels of fluorine in liquid lipsticks, waterproof mascaras, and foundations often advertised as long-lasting and wear-resistant. Peasley said that this is not entirely surprising, given PFAS are often used for their water resistance and film-forming properties. What is more concerning is that 29 products with high fluorine concentrations were tested further and found to contain between 4 and 13 specific PFAS chemicals. Only one of these items tested listed PFAS as an ingredient on the product label. "This is a red flag," Peasley said. "Our measurement indicate widespread use of PFAS in these products, but it's important to note that the full extent of use of fluorinated chemicals in cosmetics is hard to estimate due to lack of strict labeling requirements." Okay, well, I'm going to close with bonus articles that are available online, and I'll give you the link after I cite the articles. First up, expanding research complex in Berkeley highlights dangers of U.S. biolabs. There's been a lot of talk about whether the Chinese lab had something to do with COVID-19 release. And of course, even if that isn't the case, we should be concerned about biolabs. And this is an article that gets into some of the nitty-gritty of that. Two, an alleged healthcare money grab, nation's largest hospital chain cashes in on trauma centers. Three, can the CDC be fixed? Four, UN warns drought may be the next pandemic. Five, as the climate emergency grows, farm workers lack protection from deadly heat. Six, ready for a little good environmental news? This is an article that gives you a litany of better news on the environmental front. Seven, very interesting one. Psychiatry needs to get right with God. By not making more of an effort to incorporate spirituality in treatment, we are doing a disservice to patients. And last but not least, on the brighter side, eight, a surprising pandemic side effect. People are more engaged with their health. Well, you can read these or the other articles I've reported in this show. Go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, The Science of Public Health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-